Okay, well, our subject this morning is on talking to others. Now, if we are going to talk to others, we also need to learn to listen to others. And more than once is the time that I've needed to say, well, you have an interesting point there, and let me write that down for further consideration. And all I need to do is remember where I wrote it down. But talking to others, if we want them to be able to be benefiting from our conversation, we need to be kind and gentle in our conversations with them. Now, beneficial point was made very early in Brother Russell's day. The first significant book, now that's not the one on our Lord's return, but that's the one on food for thinking Christians. That was done in 1881. And the philosophy... Are we live here? Guess we're not. I guess can't move around. So, it's all okay. I was planning to have it on, but that's all right. As they started out, the idea in the Food for Thinking Christians tract was start with. Tear down the error so that they will have a firm foundation to build on. Now that sounds like reasonable thinking, doesn't it? But it didn't work very well. Because after some people had had their thoughts torn down, they never got around to building anything more and just drifted off into the world. So we'll notice that the first volume takes a different tack. It starts with Psalms 30, verse 5. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. In other words, first give people some hope, some real hope. Build up the truth and let the truth tear down the error. Now, how about the existence of a creator or of God? We can consider that some people are in doubt about that. There are some who are absolutely convinced there can't be, especially those whose lives would be contrary, obviously contrary to that of a reasonable creator. But those are not the ones that we can make much of an appeal to. But there are a lot of people who are either agnostic or unsure. So a lot of people in the world oppose that the world has arisen by random chance without the need for a creator. Because there are some things that happen by natural law. Therefore, some think that it is reasonable to assume that... everything came about by some kind of natural law. It turns out that doesn't work very well because in the DNA strands, we have the different amino acids, and they can be either this way or this way, or a different combination in different parts, and the energy is equal. But most ideas of how DNA could come to be if you did it randomly would not be biologically active. So there's something that can't be explained by natural law because natural law would only allow it to be one way. Well, so much for that. We can reasonably ask, could a single living cell arise from an ideal primordial mud somewhere? That's addressed by Stephen Meyer in his book, Signature in the Cell. Okay, now it's live. Okay. Well, what do you need in order to have a single living cell? Well, you got to have a membrane, and then you got to have at least 250 different proteins inside the membrane. Okay, so what's a protein? Well, it's composed of at least 150 different amino acids. And of these amino acids, let's see, for this I guess I've got to come back here for a moment. The amino acids are either right-handed or left-handed. But in order to be biologically active, they all have to be left-handed. And moreover, if you've got two left-handed, I can't make my right hand a left hand, but nevertheless, even after you decided that, okay, there's two chances and they're equally likely, a chemist trying to make them that way gets a combination of about 50-50. But then you hook the amino acids together, you got to have at least 150 of them in order to have a protein. But in order to fold properly, they all have to have what they call peptide bonds. Now, the bonds can be either this way or this way, equally likely. So what are the chances of getting a living cell out of a primordial mud? And we don't have to do calculus or even algebra to figure this one out, because first, we have to have these things, what they call levorotary, or left-handed. And so you say you got to have 150 of these minimum. So what are the chances? One chance in 2 to the 150th power. And okay, then they've got to be bonded in the correct direction. What's the chances of that happening with 150 amino acids? And, the bonds between them is one less than the number of acids, so you multiply it by 2 to the 149th power. Usually we round that out to say 150, because even 150 is a minimum. And then a fellow named Douglas Axe has done some experimentation to find out how much change you can make with a biologically active protein. And he's decided that on the order of one chance in 10 to the 74th power is the chance of a random protein being biologically active. Now, in order to be biologically active, it has to fold up right. You get one thing wrong and part of it won't fold up right. So you multiply 2 to the 150th by 2 to the 149th power times 10 to the 74th power. Well, in order to reduce it to understandable terms, well, 2 is 10 to the 0.3 power, or actually 0.301. So you got about 10 to the 45th power times another 10 to the 45th power times 10 to the 74th power. But to have enough proteins for a biologically alive cell, you have to have at least 250 of these proteins. So you raise this again by a 250th power, and you get one chance in 10 to the 41,000th power. Well, you know, we only have 10 to the 80th atoms in the whole universe. We don't even have 10 to the 20th seconds in the entire universe's history. So, now, that doesn't solve all the problems. You got another problem. Where did that membrane come from? Nobody's ever seen one arise from no apparent cause. And besides which, Suppose you take a single living cell, let's blow it up big in the microscope, and take a little needle and poke a little hole in the membrane. And what you see is these proteins come spewing out of it. And not just dribbling out, they come spewing out of it. So even if you had the membrane and you had 250 or so necessary proteins, how would you ever get them into a membrane unless you did it deliberately? Even then, you'd be awfully lucky. So those proteins cannot get into the membrane on their own, because that would be a violation of the second law of thermodynamics that says all processes tend towards randomness. So there's only one reasonable conclusion. If it can't happen by natural law, and it's totally implausible that it could happen by random chance, then the only reasonable answer is there had to be an intelligent designer, an intelligent and very powerful and wise creator. These are some of the ways that we could approach a person who is really in doubt about whether the scriptures can be completely reliable. But now, we say the Bible came by divine revelation. So what's the evidence? Well, DNA shows that all women are descended from a common female ancestor. This was discovered in the lifetimes of many of us. Now, Rebecca Kahn up at UC Berkeley with a fellow named Stone King and a fellow named Wilson discovered that only in 1987, and boy, were they surprised. At the time, they made an estimate acknowledging that it was what they considered a best estimate, not a calculation, really, of maybe it was around 200,000 years ago within a factor of two. But then, 8 years later, Robert Dorrit and at Yale and a couple of others, University of Chicago and Harvard, discovered that all men in the world are descended from a common male ancestor. Now, a fellow named Jobling, and I think there was another one too, was around this time publishing results, just very preliminary results, that the rate of mutations of the DNA has been grossly underestimated. That things are going to be more recent than that 200,000-year estimate. Well, there was a fellow in the civilian world, Thomas Parsons and his crew, that did some further more definitive experiments to discover there really aren't that many divergences in the male DNA. And there was a fellow in the military world, Neil Howell, who did likewise. And they both came up with virtually the same answer within maybe 10 or 20%, but with a big statistical uncertainty. And the result was that the mitochondrial Eve, as they refer to her, must have been only about 6,000 to 6,500 years ago. A gal named Ann Gibbons was lecturing to a group of evolutionists, and she points out that with this new calibrated rate, the mitochondrial Eve would only have been about 6,000 years ago. But to do her obeisance to evolution, she says, of course, nobody believes that. this is not merely estimates. This is based on measurements of the rate of divergence of the DNA. So the DNA is quite favorable to the Genesis account and the Genesis chronology, for that matter, also. Another interesting thing. Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, it gives us the six or seven creative days, quote unquote, epochs. Oh, I should quote somebody who has my name, James Parkinson. He's the one who first reported on the disease, I think it was about 1817. But he was also the first one to report on fossils, first one in the English language to describe fossils. And he concluded from his studies that each of the creative days of Genesis must be at least 10,000 years long. Not too bad for a start, is it? So, in these creative days, we start with there was light and there was darkness. That tells you something. That was all dark. Had to create the light. That's right, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, if the atmosphere was so thick that the sunlight couldn't get through it, that tells you that something well over 100 atmospheres of pressure was necessary, several hundred probably. It also tells you that the temperature was less than 700 degrees Kelvin, or otherwise the atmosphere would be self-luminous. It would make its own light, and you couldn't turn it off. So anyway, you look at it, and in the second day, when it separates the waters above from the waters below, that separation only takes place at about 220 atmospheres of pressure. Now, that'd be a little difficult for me to breathe in. Be pretty heavy. But as you look in, at the various things, and you get down to the fourth creative day, and first you see the sun, then you see the moon, then you see the stars, you're watching the atmosphere decrease from 10 atmospheres of pressure to 2 atmospheres of pressure to 1.1 atmospheres of pressure. We see a steady decrease in the atmospheric pressure. Now, how did Moses know about atmospheric optics and physical chemistry at that time? Well, could be he got the message from somebody who was there when it happened. In fact, he made it happen. Now, compare that with, say, things from the Hindu religion, some of the other religions, where maybe the earth was carried on the back of the strong man? Not very likely. Or some have it on the back of an alligator. But what's shown in Genesis 1 is entirely consistent with what people measure, whether geology or other sciences. Not at all unreasonable. Moreover, it starts with the creation of the fruit grasses and the fruit trees. And so you look through the order of creation, and it creates the food chain from bottom to top. That's reasonable too, isn't it? You wouldn't want a piece of it missing in between. But now, a strong indicator of divine revelation should be the ability to unambiguously prophesy future events. Now, before I get into one, they say, well, there are others who gave prophecies that came true. like the oracle that told the king of Persia, cross the river and you will destroy a great power. And sure enough, he did his own. That was Xerxes. The Ahasuerus, let's say Ahasuerus of the Hebrew Bible. Well, now then, let's consider a prophecy like Amos. Last couple of verses of Amos. That's chapter 9. We'll take time to read from the 11th verse to the end. As soon as I can get there. Here we are. In that day will I raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen, and close up the breaches thereof, and I will raise up its ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations that are called by my name, saith Jehovah, that doeth this. Behold, the days come, saith Jehovah, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him that soweth seed. And the mountains shall drop sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt. And I will bring back the captivity of my people Israel, and they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and drink the wine thereof. They shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them. And I will plant them upon their land, and they shall be no more plucked up out of their land which I have given them, saith Jehovah thy God. In verse 11, I have to confess an error, a mistake which I made a good many years ago. It says, in that day will I raise up the tabernacle of David that has fallen. Well, I was certain, I was sure, if it had to do with the tabernacle, then it surely pertained to the church, not to fleshly Israel. And then several years ago, I think someone may have pointed out, or perhaps I found it on my own, that word for tabernacle is not ohel or mishkan, the usual ones that we see in the Leviticus tabernacle, but rather sukkoth or sukkoh. The Feast of Sukkoth is what's called commonly the Feast of Tabernacles or Feast of Booths, and that's in the fall. So I want to make my confession now. If that's talking about the Feast of Tabernacles, that's a reference to the Millennial Age. Why do I say that? Well, the last chapter of Zechariah says that the nations will come up from year to keep the Feast of Sukkoth, Tabernacles, Booths. So that shows it to be a Millennial Age picture, that seven-day feast, in the fall, not in the spring. And I will raise up its ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom. Edom, that was the other name of Esau, Jacob's brother. Just as Jacob was renamed Israel, so Esau was renamed Edom. Sometimes in scriptures we see it as Edom, maybe occasionally as Edomia. And all the nations that are called by my name, saith Jehovah. Nations that are called by the name of Jehovah. This has to have something to do with nations that at least professedly were Christian. Behold, the days come, saith Jehovah, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes, him that soweth seed. Well, when the plowman overtakes the reaper, well, that's the end of the harvest, isn't it? Once the plowman's gone by, what are you going to harvest? That's the conclusion of the harvest that's referred to there. And the treader of grapes, him that soweth seed. And the mountains shall drop sweet wine, some say that's grape juice, and all the hills shall melt. Well, we would understand at the end of this age, the various nations will melt because they will come into Israel if they want to stay around at all. And I will bring back the captivity of my people Israel, and they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. Is that taking place in your day and mine? It certainly is, isn't it? And this is not a small thing. In the 18th century, before Brother Russell was born, there was an occasional Protestant in England who would be telling about the restoration of Israel. And in the 1870s and afterwards, Brother Russell picked up on the theme and broadcast it more widely. And of course, he and the other Bible students were ridiculed because how could it happen? They had been out of the land for 17 centuries. What was the chances of their returning, really? All their hopes were dried up, so it appeared. I've got a chance just to briefly review some of the interesting things that have happened. As nearly as I can tell, there were no major world events before the late 1800s. Example of that was Napoleon, and he's considered one that worked fast, and he mowed down the opposition quickly, partly because the opposition hadn't been a very good society either, been pretty evil. So there were a lot of people that weren't anxious to defend it. That aided him in his moving. But he moved no faster in his day than Alexander the Great had in the 300 BC era. Nowadays, what happens when there's a problem 1,000 miles away or even 10,000 miles away? Due to the airplanes and the ability to take equipment in the belly of the airplanes, why, they can be there in 24 hours. Something is different, definitely different. As far as I can tell, the first major world event that really had a worldwide impact was what's called the Long Depression. At the time, they called it the Great Depression. But then in the 1930s, they wanted the expression for the 1930s depression. So they renamed it the Long Depression. Why? Because it lasted on the order of 20 years. It started with stock market panics in Vienna first in 1873, and then in September of that year. Consequent, there was another thing that happened in the Balkan Peninsula, and that is the fall planting of 1874 resulted in a miserably poor harvest in the spring of 1875. The result was that the Christian farmers couldn't pay their taxes, which were higher than those of Muslims, deliberately. The Ottoman Empire saw to that. And the Turkish people came in, and they just grabbed everything. They took the food, they took the furniture, they took everything they could find, leaving them with nothing. And this resulted in what's called the Christian Revolt of June and July of 1875. Well, it was brutally repressed by the Ottoman Empire. The following year, I think it was Serbia and Montenegro declared war on the Ottoman Empire, and they were brutally crushed. Then 1877, the Russians found that their influence in the Balkan Peninsula was virtually nil. They couldn't afford a war, but they also couldn't afford not to. So they declared war on the Ottoman Empire. And by February of 1878, they had captured Adrianople, just 100 miles from the Turkish capital. That got the Turks' attention, and so they signed what was called a Treaty of San Stefano. Well, that granted dominance of the Balkan Peninsula to the Russians now, and that was not acceptable to the rest of Europe. So they called together a conference in Berlin, Congress of Nations, to resolve the matter. And one result was the British Prime Minister, who was, by ethnicity, he was a Jew. But his father had seen to it that all of his children were baptized in the Anglican Church back in about 1815, which made him eligible to become Prime Minister. Accident? Anyway, he could tell the Pasha of Turkey or the Ottoman Empire, so look, you guys are broke. You've already declared bankruptcy back in 1875, and you've got all this no good land over in Palestine that's doing nothing for you. I think I can find some buyers for you, and you get the money. That caught his attention. So it became possible now for anyone to go and buy and own land in Palestine. The Jews were not slow to take advantage of it. The first new Jewish community in Palestine was established in October of 1878. And that's the one we call Petah Tikva. Petah, door of, and Tikva, hope. So door of hope. And the next month, in November, it was Guy Oni, and approximately every month thereafter, a new Jewish community was reestablished in Palestine. Things were beginning to change. Now, it took a long time. It took till 1929 before there was 1% of world Jewry back in the land. And then came Adolf Hitler. He didn't campaign against the Jews, but once he got into power and he heard from the Mufti of Jerusalem, then he went after the Jews. Not all of them. Some had critical occupations. I knew one. She was studying nuclear engineering with me, and we didn't say anything more. Anyway, today, through the events of the Great Depression and World War II and the Soviet oppression of Jews, over 40% of world Jewry is back in the land, and it continues to grow. The Jews are not stupid, you know. They urge the young ones to go back, those who have the strength to build up the country. Well, the old folks stay behind and fund the effort so that it will be the old folks that die off in the foreign countries, and it will be the new ones who expand the population in the promised land. So these things are happening in our own day. The return is being accompanied by uncounted miracles, as well as much murderous opposition. But now, you hear all of these things against Israel. Almost everything that's passed in the UN is against Israel. Nothing against North Korea, nothing against Iran, nothing against Arabia. But almost always it's against Israel. Well, how do you know who's telling the truth then? if almost the whole world is against Israel, is it because Israel is bad? Well, just ask yourself the question. Where would you like to walk the streets? Would you like to walk the streets in Tel Aviv? Or in Gaza? Or in Ramallah in the West Bank? Well, in the latter two, you probably wouldn't have to worry about it very long. But in the streets of Tel Aviv, there are Jews, there are Christians, there are Arabs, including Muslim Arabs. I think it's pretty easy to see who's telling the truth. Even if it is the smaller voice, still, the truth is the truth, and it's testable. So, the ability to make prophecies that come true and come consistently true is the evidence that our Bible was written by one who not only knows what will happen, he can cause it to happen and cause it to happen at the right time. Now, all things do not continue as they have always been. There are epochs in the history of the world, history of the earth, and there are dispensations in the history of the human race. They do not all continue as they always have been. Even the world can see that there's differences between the Jewish age and the Christian age, or gospel age. And they can also see what a huge difference the Industrial Revolution has made in more recent times. I remember reading one historian made the notation that almost all great societies or kingdoms or empires were a result of one guy conquering a whole bunch of the others. Until we came to the Industrial Revolution, and that is when empires began to become great because they produced more goods or they were able to trade goods around the whole globe. Now, this is only in the last very few hundred years. Something is greatly different. And, of course, we live in the nuclear age. And then they wanted to call it the brain age. I think probably it's better to be known as the age of insecurity. 50 or 100 years should take care of that, however. Now, each creative day in Genesis 1 shows for us a different epoch. Something that's radically different from what went before it. And I think maybe I can toss this in. You note how it says, the evening and the morning were the nth day. The evening and the morning. When would that begin if we were talking about a literal day? Would it begin at sunset? No, then it would say the night and the day were the nth day. Does it begin at sunrise? No, then I would say the day and the night were the nth day. Does it begin at midnight? Well, no, then we would say the morning and the evening were the nth day. But the idea here would be something equivalent to the noon beginning of the day. And what it's telling us in Genesis 1 is the sun goes down on the old conditions and it comes up to the full in the new set of conditions. Hence, the evening and the morning were the nth day in each case. Now again, There are differences in the ages from the flood to the millennium. In that, we see the period, we call it the period of the patriarchs, for want of a better description of it. It's the time when Babylon arose, first time around, the old kingdom of Babylon, and other evils arose in the earth. But then came the time for Israel to emerge under the 12 tribes. And here's a case where you may say, well, when does the Jewish age really begin? And some may say it begins at Jacob's death when Israel emerged as a 12-tribe kingdom. Or others will say, maybe really it arises with the law, when God gave them a law. The Gentiles had their own laws, but God gave the law, as we see in the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. But there's a difference between those laws. In God's law given through Moses, it is no respecter of persons. In the laws of Ur-Nammu, or Eshnunna, or Hammurabi, if you were wealthy, you had privileges that the others did not have. You could do things that others could not get away with. So that is the difference. God's law is no respecter of persons. It shall be one law to you and to the stranger who is among you. So where are we now? Well, as we mentioned, Alexander the Great moved his armies just as fast as Napoleon moved his. And by the way, if you're a Persian, he's not Alexander the Great, he's Alexander the Terrible. Under him, 2 million people lost their lives. Now, I know that's peanuts compared with the 20th century. Yeah, I'll just mention a thing or two about that. We do have time. In the 20th century, in comes Adolf Hitler. And he is responsible for the death of, there are various estimates, but pick a median estimate, about 17 million people. He's the third greatest murderer of the recent times, the 20th century. Who's ahead of him? Joseph Stalin, somewhere between 30 and 50 million people lost their lives on his account. A good many of them through the starvation, through the collectivization of the farms, the loss of incentive to produce on the part of those who were growing it. So give him maybe 35 million, being generous. But he's only the second greatest murderer of the 20th century. Can you guess who's number one? That's right, Chairman Mao. At perhaps 60 or 70 million people. Now, the atheist loves to blame Christianity for mass murders. The two greatest mass murderers of all time were both leftists. And how about Adolf Hitler? Well, he wasn't very Christian, as far as we can tell, but his political party was the National Socialist Party. National Socialist Party? Does that sound very opposite to left wing? So what we can say is the mass murderers of all time. Say, take the top 10. Somewhere between 70 and 90% of that came from the hard left. Now, that's not liberals. That's the hard left. So how much is Christianity to blame for? Yeah, we must acknowledge that Leopold II in Belgium, when he personally owned the Congo, murdered somewhere between 2 and 15 million. Not that he actually behaved as Christians. And really, I won't blame the nation of Belgium for it, because he personally had taken the Congo for his own possession. And once he'd murdered all those people, then he gave it to the nation of Belgium after the dirty deed was done. That's really quite an aside. Since the 1870s, major events have become worldwide problems. Would you call it plagues? Christianity is decreasing. Israel is returning. Therefore, we are near the end of this gospel age, or literally the expression is the consummation of this gospel age, its harvest. That's maybe a significant point. You speak of the end of the world. Well, sounds like a calamity, certainly, doesn't it? But the consummation of the age, it means something is being grasped. Something is being, there is a result, a desirable result from all this period of time. And those results are twofold. One is the completion of the church, who have learned to love even their enemies. And the other is bringing Israel back to their land with a spirit of kindness, tolerance, and even goodness towards people who are not their own. And even some of those who are hating them, they have been kind to, like the Hadassah Hospital will take in anyone to bring them back to health. Calls to mind seeing one video clip where an Arab Muslim lady said, "We call you pigs, we call you apes. We know it isn't true, but we have to say it or they will kill us." And there are people behind those enemy lines who know better. So we can see that when the kingdom does come, there will be some behind those, quote, enemy lines, unquote, who will be ready to receive the kingdom blessings. So then, what should we do? What should you and I be doing? One, tell the truth and let the truth tear down the lies. After all, there are all kinds of different lies. How are you going to beat them all down? Obviously, the most effective way is build up the truth so that people can see the truth and let the lies dissolve before it. Second, stay off the hate Israel bandwagon that is so lively today. Three, be not rebellious against authorities, whether they lie to us or not. Still, do not be rebellious against the authorities. That is not for us. And four, avoid the spirit of accusation. Do we see a lot of accusation in this world today? Accusation usually tells you more about the accuser than it does about the accused. And what's the literal meaning of the word devil? That's right. The literal meaning of the word devil is accuser. So let's not be on his side. love covereth a multitude of sins.